Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, who assesses the multiple uprisings challenging autocratic regimes across the Middle East and North Africa. Michael Zweig, director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life at the State University of New York, who looks at the massive pro-union protests challenging the governor of Wisconsin's effort to slash worker rights. And Susan Yolen, vice president of Planned Parenthood of Southern New England, who discusses a Republican-approved bill in the House that would cut all federal funding to the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The BBC reports international relief efforts to deal with massive damage from Haiti's devastating January 2010 earthquake that killed some 230,000 people may have contributed to the recent cholera outbreak in the island nation. A recent report by researchers at the City University of New York blamed aid groups for not addressing the need to reverse decades of rapid urbanization in Port-au-Prince, the capital city, and the epicenter of the earthquake. Aid agencies and the Haitian government failed to seize the opportunity to promote rural agricultural development and rebuild rural infrastructure in relief and rebuilding programs. Instead, aid groups centered food for work programs in Port-au-Prince, whose population had soared over the last 20 years due to neoliberal economic policies that encouraged the rural poor to seek low-paying factory jobs in cities. With most of the aid centered in Port-au-Prince, it was predictable that relief camps there exploded to over 1.7 million people in the aftermath of the earthquake, increasing the level of poor sanitation. The cholera epidemic, which killed 3,600 people since October 2010, is spread through contact with human feces. The City University of New York study concluded that aid agencies have failed to address the root causes of cholera, which is endemic poverty and unemployment that were present in Haiti long before the earthquake. Only weeks before the uprisings began to sweep the Arab world, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visited Bahrain, where she praised the small Persian Gulf state ruled by King Hamad bin Isa al-Khalifa for its commitment to democratic reforms. In mid-February, the streets of Bahrain filled with majority Shiite protesters opposed to the Sunni monarchy. Security forces moved to violently clear Pearl Square in the capital city of Manama, resulting in the deaths of nonviolent protesters. Secretary Clinton and European leaders condemned the crackdown. Britain, the former colonial power, withheld arms export licenses to the Gulf state. Several days after the initial crackdown, Bahrain security forces pulled back and Pearl Square was filled with Shia pro-democracy protesters. The government has now opened talks with the protest movement. Bahrain, which borders on Saudi Arabia, is an important Washington ally and is home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet. According to ProPublica, American diplomats have long been aware of brewing tensions between Shia and Sunnis in Bahrain, including complaints by young Shiites of discrimination in housing, employment, and the slow pace of reform. The Obama administration has outlined a series of options to downsize the government-sponsored mortgage agencies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which would transfer more power over home ownership to the private market. According to the American Prospect magazine, the downsizing of the two hybrid housing institutions would harm government efforts to promote home ownership and reduce funds going into housing. As an alternative, the Obama administration is talking about expanding the role of the Community Reinvestment Act, CRA, that bars banks from redlining or discriminating against low-income communities. For over 75 years, the federal government has promoted home ownership first through federal agencies and then government-sponsored corporations. Freddie Mac was created in the 1970s to manage the secondary mortgage market. During the height of the recent housing bubble, both Fannie and Freddie purchased mortgage-backed securities, which included loans to low-income borrowers, in order to preserve overall market share, which inflated their stock price before the 2008 market crash. Now the federal government has taken over the two mortgage agencies. In the new proposals, the Obama administration is looking to scale back expectations on home ownership and allow mortgage rates to rise, which will reduce access to home loans for low and moderate income families. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
Since the eruption of militant protests, which overthrew Tunisia's dictator in mid-January, uprisings have spread across the Middle East and North Africa. After the unexpected fall of staunch U.S. ally Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, other autocratic regimes in the region are being challenged by their people in the streets like never before. Anti-government protests have been quickly organized in a diverse group of nations, including Bahrain, Yemen, Algeria, Morocco, Iran, Djibouti, Jordan, Kuwait, Sudan, and Syria. The embattled monarchy of Bahrain, home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, initially cracked down on protesters, but in recent days the police and the army have pulled back and the royal family has offered some concessions. Rising violence has also been seen against protesters demanding the ouster of U.S.-backed Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh. But some of the worst violence reported thus far in this wave of Middle East protests is taking place in Libya, where government troops loyal to Muammar Gaddafi, in power for 41 years, are battling anti-regime demonstrators. News reporters have been banned from Libya. However, some eyewitness accounts say as many as 300 people have been killed. In a televised address on February 22nd, Gaddafi vowed to fight to his last drop of blood and die as a martyr at the end. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report. He examines the common threads between the protest movements that have been unleashed across the region over the past 2 months and the response of the U.S. government that has for decades supported many of the dictatorships now under attack.
Every country has its unique set of circumstances, its particularities, and the outbreak of an uprising in Algeria would have different approximate causes than in Jordan and so on. But there are some things that are shared in common by all of these countries that have seen mass protests in the last couple of months. And I think it's important to note that the unrest started in Tunisia, which is in many ways a country that is sort of the archetypal Arab autocracy, which we see replicated in capitals across the region. And to wit, you have pretty much an absolute distinction between the state and the society. You had also a state that was increasingly dominated by a very narrow clique around the ruling family of President Ben Ali, and a very, you know, small group of close cronies. And you had a population that was living in a great deal of fear on a daily basis. And so, you know, the idea was, for a long time, that these regimes could essentially follow, you know, what we might call the China model, a modified China model, whereby you could have economic liberalization, the opening up of the economic sphere, without any parallel political liberalization. And Tunisia was kind of the archetype of that sort of regime. So for the archetype of that kind of regime to fall in the course of a month through almost entirely peaceful popular protests, almost all of the violence in Tunisia was waged by the state against the protesters. For that to happen in that way in such a short time absolutely galvanized the entire region. It had a couple of effects. First, it just absolutely shattered this psychological barrier, this barrier of fear of the regimes and their security services, which had prevented populations from carrying out these kinds of uprisings before. It showed that a dictator, no matter how strong his police force is, no matter how much cash he had lavished on his security services over the years, and no matter how staunch his backing from various Western capitals, he could still be overthrown through people power in the street.
Chris, as we've seen these multiple challenges across the Middle East and North Africa, I've heard some historians talk about a similar wave of a dissent against autocratic regimes in Eastern Europe in the late 1980s, before the collapse of the Soviet Union. Interestingly, of course, during that time, the United States was on the side opposing the Soviet Union and its satellite states. Here, though, in the Middle East, we have the United States long and fast allies of these dictators. What is the long-term consequences, in your view, for United States foreign policy, where the main pillars have seemed to be to protect our access to oil, to protect Israel, and ensure stability at all costs?
Right. Well, I think what we're seeing is that the third of those pillars, the pillar of stability, is crumbling into dust. And the United States has been in a very tight spot with the uprisings in Egypt in particular, and subsequently, particularly what's been happening in Bahrain and Yemen and Jordan and, to a lesser extent, Libya. Even Gaddafi, too, is now a U.S. Arab ally. So the U.S. is hence in a similar spot with him. And basically what the Obama administration has tried to do is speak out of both sides of its mouth. The United States cannot come out forthrightly and say we don't support people demonstrating for their natural rights as human beings in the streets. So, of course, U.S. politicians from Obama to Hillary Clinton on down have said many times that the United States supports the protesters' demands, or at least supports political reform that would satisfy some of the protesters' demands. But on the other hand, the U.S. has not, in any of these cases, made very forceful statements at all vis-a-vis the autocrats who are using various means of coercion to put down the protests. The U.S., subsequently, in Tunisia and in Egypt, the places where the regime change has already occurred, is taking steps to try to ensure that there is still a stable government there that can be trusted to carry out various roles in support of U.S. strategic goals in the region. Senators McCain and Lieberman were in Tunisia praising the steps that the regime remnant there has taken to affect a political transition in Tunisia, and offering continued security aid to continue to beef up Tunisia's security services, the very same police that Tunisians were in the streets demonstrating against before Ben Ali's downfall. So I don't think that these events are going to magically change the whole focus of U.S. grand strategy in the region for the last 60 years, but I do think that the successor regimes, or I hope successor governments, I hope the term government will be more appropriate in the future, in these countries, I'm not sure that they will be willing to play their appointed role in U.S. grand strategy any longer. And that, I think, is the key question, rather than the policy orientation of Washington. So this is a tremendously important historical moment. It's hard to know where it's leading, but for sure, the region is just never going to be the same again. And the political culture of the region, if nothing else, has been changed for good.
That was Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, published by the Middle East Research and Information Project. Read their analysis online at merip.org. With a slow recovery from the nation's worst recession since the Great Depression, shrinking revenue and federal stimulus money running out, many state governments are struggling to balance their budgets. Some Republican governors are now exploiting the economic shortfall to demand deep cuts in the wages and benefits of state employees, with a few directly attempting to undercut the very power and legitimacy of labor unions. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is among the first GOP politicians to launch what is apparently a coordinated, conservative-led nationwide attack on public employee unions. Although Wisconsin unions have agreed to all of Walker's proposed salary, health insurance, and pension cuts to address a $137 million budget gap, the governor, backed by campaign cash from the right-wing billionaire Koch brothers, won't back down from his primary demand. His goal is to take away public employees' right to collectively bargain with the state. 14 Democratic state senators left Wisconsin February 17th to deny the GOP-controlled Senate a quorum and a vote on the governor's anti-union legislation. Similar showdowns between Republican governors and unions are already underway in Ohio, Indiana, Florida, and Tennessee. In response to the Wisconsin assault on unions, enormous protests in solidarity with public employees have overwhelmed the state capitol in Madison with tens of thousands and as many as 70,000 pro-union demonstrators, marching daily for more than a week. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Zweig, professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. Zweig examines the wider significance of the massive pro-union protests, challenging the Wisconsin governor's effort to slash worker rights.
What we have is a governor backed by the Koch brothers and the Tea Party and the most right-wing elements in the Republican Party pushing to destroy unions. Now, why would they want to do that? Well, they'd want to destroy unions because unions are really the only organizations in this country that have the capacity and the numbers, even as diminished as they are, to put up a credible challenge to the power of the corporations. And, of course, corporations don't want to have any challenge anywhere, so they set about systematically to erode the power of unions. And that's true in the private sector as well as in the public sector. So we've had over the last 30 years or so a very dedicated campaign in the private sector to limit what unions can do and to limit the ability of workers to organize. And the result has been great shrinkage of union membership in the private sector. Until now, it's less than 7% of workers in the United States in the private sector are in unions. It's just astounding. It's back to the 1920s. So having chased unions down in the private sector, now the time has come, they think, to destroy unions in the public sector. And that's what we're seeing. And it's plain that this claims about budget deficits and fiscal crises are irrelevant to their plan. In Wisconsin, the governor, when he first came into office, gave tax breaks of $140 million to corporations in the state of Wisconsin. And that increased the deficit, of course, by that amount. And now he's trying to get givebacks from workers of just about the same amount. So it isn't a fiscal question. It isn't a question of what do we do about the deficits, because they're perfectly happy to increase the deficits if it comes to giving money to the wealthy and to the corporations. It's just when it comes time for workers to have their interests met that all of a sudden there's a budget crisis.
Professor Zweig, since the inception of the labor movement, unions have set the standard for wages and benefits for the rest of the population. People who are not unionized benefited from the labor campaign for the 40-hour week, for weekends off, for vacations, for health care benefits, and on and on and on. What's at stake here with this battle in Wisconsin and the other states where the Republican governors are trying to attack the heart and soul of labor organizing?
Well, I think two things are going to result from this attack on the public sector if it works. It's not just a problem for the public sector workers. It's a problem for everybody, because weakening the public sector unions will further weaken the private sector unions, which will drag down the standard of living for working people in general, not just the union workers, because, as you say, unions often set the pattern that non-union employers had to meet, particularly if they didn't want to get a union in their workplace. They would pay their workers the union scale, thinking that that would ward off the union. So if unions can't do that for people, they can't extend better working conditions and better pay, but are constantly on the defensive and constantly losing, it shrinks the capacity of unions everywhere. That's one point. So the other point is, particularly if we're talking about the public sector, if you destroy the teachers' unions and you destroy the unions that represent the police, the firefighters, and the clerical workers and everybody else, what's going to happen is that those workers are going to get laid off. Those workers are going to be treated worse. There are going to be fewer services provided. And that damages everybody, not just the workers in terms of their jobs and their income, but the public in terms of the services that are provided in the parks and in the school districts and in the police and the fire and so on and so forth. It really is an attack on the whole society. And I think finally, in this instance in Wisconsin, there is a flashpoint that people are getting that point and they're really standing up. We'll see how it unfolds.
Do you think the AFL-CIO, and specifically Richard Trumka, was with the United Mine Workers and employed some militant tactics in the field during the Pittston strike back in 1989 and 1990 with some very good results? Do you think we're about to see organized labor in this country take advantage of the spark in Wisconsin to get militant and do their best to educate people in the country who may be skeptical about the value of unions?
Well, I certainly think that this big battle in Wisconsin is really illuminating for people around the country the importance of unions. That brings the question of the legitimacy of unions straight into the focal point. And I think that that is an argument that people are going to have to confront. And we'll see what the labor movement is able to do. And we'll see what, working people in general, not just in unions, are able to do in responding to that question.
That was Michael Zweig, professor of economics and director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. Visit the center's website at stonybrook.edu/workingclass. After an all-night session on February 19th, the House of Representatives passed a continuing budget resolution that zeroes out Title X, the decades-old federal family planning program, and an amendment to the resolution that cuts all federal funding to the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Planned Parenthood, which runs 800 health centers around the country, provides a wide spectrum of services addressing women's health. Indiana Republican Representative Mike Pence, who sponsored the Planned Parenthood amendment, called the vote a victory for taxpayers and a victory for life because, he stated, Planned Parenthood provides abortions. But women seeking abortions constitute just 10% of Planned Parenthood's patients in most states, while the vast majority of women go to the group's clinics for pregnancy prevention and basic health care. Federal, state, and local grants total $363 million, or one-third of Planned Parenthood's $1 billion national budget. 90% of that is in federal grants or Medicaid payments. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Susan Yolen, Vice President of Planned Parenthood of Southern New England, covering Connecticut and Rhode Island. She explains the history of these funding streams, how women are benefiting, and what's likely to happen if the cuts overcome opposition in the Democratic-controlled U.S. Senate and an expected presidential veto.
Actually, we weren't surprised at all. We were expecting it. I think that Mr. Pence has been around with this kind of language for years. He just hasn't had the groundswell, I guess, of support from leadership that he now has with the new Republican majority. So we weren't surprised. We were bracing for it.
Let's talk about the Title X funding first. What would that mean? Just for listeners, just describe what Title X funding is and what Planned Parenthood affiliates get and what its cut would mean.
Well, Title X is the National Family Planning Program. It was founded back in the early 1970s by President Nixon, believe it or not, back in the days when it was a very positive Republican value to support family planning. So it's been around for all those years, and it really is the core of our national program to help women prevent unintended pregnancy. But more than that, it provides vital screenings for young people and low-income women. So this is where, the annual exam, the pap smear, the clinical breast exam, the testing and treatment for STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, all of which is covered by Title X for those who qualify, who are low-income women and oftentimes young women who are in their first job or just don't have insurance.
Can you clarify the funding that was proposed to be cut specifically from Planned Parenthood? Does that sort of roll over into Title X funding, or are they two separate pots?
Well, there are two things going on here. One is the Congress saying Planned Parenthood should get not a dollar of federal money, no matter what the source is. So Title X is one of those sources, but there are other sources of revenue that come in our door. For example, about 30% of our patients are on Medicaid. And when they come to us with their Medicaid card, Medicaid is the payer for their care. So that would be also something that would be out of bounds for us.
So Mike Pence, I noticed on his website, he says it's really going to cut funding for abortions. So what percentage of Planned Parenthood's money goes for abortion? I mean, you do a lot of other things as well.
Well, it varies across the country, but here in Connecticut and Rhode Island, I mean, it's about, you know, less than 10% of our patients and our services are abortion-focused. So the vast majority of our work is basic pregnancy prevention, basic health visits, cancer screenings in particular. So it's really not abortion-focused, and none of the federal money that we get actually does go for abortion because of legislation that was passed years ago and continues to be renewed, called the Hyde Amendment, which says that only in very, very extreme cases could a woman access an abortion with federal dollars.
I know you're hoping that all the people who support reproductive rights and access to health care for women hope that this is going to die in the Senate. Is that your expectation?
Well, I think it's our cautiously optimistic expectation. We certainly aren't taking anything for granted. We are going to be working diligently between now and whenever the Senate votes to make sure that every senator who supports family planning, and there are folks who are, by the way, not pro-choice on the abortion issue, but do understand the importance of preventing pregnancy and will vote with us in that regard. So we are hoping to get every vote we can. I'd just like to talk about the availability of family planning, because honestly, every dollar the government spends on family planning saves $4. This has been documented over and over again. So
how does it do that?
Well, by preventing the cost associated with an unplanned pregnancy. So right away, within the first 9 months, because that's how long a pregnancy takes, you're saving money on prenatal care visits, labor and delivery, and particularly sometimes, you know, the neonatal intensive care kind of cost that drives the cost of delivery up very high. So we will be losing money by not investing in family planning.
If a low-income person needs family planning, birth control, and can't get it, the likelihood of many more unplanned pregnancies seems the inevitable result. And then along with that, probably within that group of unplanned pregnancies, an increase among some of those women trying to figure out one way or another how to get an abortion.
Yeah, absolutely. That is clearly the case. You know, I mean, every unintended pregnancy is somebody's individual decision to make. And certainly, I mean, just getting back to the economy for a moment, I mean, right now it's a particularly difficult time for someone to not be able to afford that monthly pill pack that is really what's keeping her from pregnancy.
That was Susan Yolen of Planned Parenthood. Contact the group at area code 202-973-4800. Or visit their website at plannedparenthood.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.